Good evening, everyone. The meeting of the Ways and Means Committee will come to order. Clerk will note the roll. There is a quorum. Members, we have the minutes of Wednesday, March 23rd before us. Representative Carlson moves approval of the minutes. Any questions, additions, changes to the minutes? Seeing none, all in favor of the minutes, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. The minutes are approved. Members, we have two items of business tonight. House File 4, the tax bill. House File 888, the environment bill. First up is Chair Davids with the tax bill. And Chair Davids moves that House File 4 be referred to the General Register. Chair Davids, do you want to explain? Why don't you explain the bill first, and then we can get to the amendments.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. House File 4 our target was $5,216,687,000. Our actual is $5,214,297, and so we left about $2.39 million on the bottom line. So our bill has met its targets. Actually, we're just a bit under the target. So with that, Mr. Chair, this is the come-together tax bill. We need to come together and get a bill signed this year, and that's what we're going to do.
And do we get to hear you sing, Chairman Davids?
No. Although I am the number one requested funeral singer in Fillmore County.
I'm not surprised.
I was.
All right. Well, we have one amendment that I believe is a fairly technical amendment, which is the, I think it's the A26 amendment. Is that correct, Representative Davids?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, members. I would move the H0004A26 amendment. And this was just a slight oversight we had. Basically, this is a provision for Representative Mary Murphy's district for the city of Proctor. And the way the bill stands right now, it would say they need to go out for an election to do this. It has to do with the sales tax. And they've already had the election, so we just, the amendment puts it to November 4th of 2014, which would clear that up. They've already had the election.
Okay. Is there any discussion to the A26 amendment? Seeing no discussion, all in favor of the A26 amendment, say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. The A26 amendment is adopted. And Representative Davids, do you have any other amendments?
No, sir. No, Mr. Chairman, I do not.
All right. I see there are two other amendments, A24 and A25. Is there someone that wants to move one of those amendments? Representative Marquardt?
I will move the A25 amendment.
Representative Marquardt moves the A25 amendment. Representative Marquardt.
Think about it. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So what this, you know, we talked about back last week in the Ways and Means about the targets. I know today isn't the targets, but one was the fact that we would have education as the top dollar amount and not a tax bill. But that we talked about last week. This isn't so much right-sizing as much as it is to provide a better balance. And so what this amendment, the A25 amendment, does, it is the working family credit that was in the governor's, well, in the tax bill last year, and the governor's proposal. And with that, it takes money away from the extra benefits being provided in the estate tax. And so, you know, I think, members, it's a pretty easy choice here. The working family credit is one of those things in our tax code that actually does a lot of things that we, I think, all agree on. And the working family credit has always been a very bipartisan bill, Democrats and Republicans, not only on the statewide level, where we, you know, it was in last year's tax bill, which I think probably almost everyone around this table, not everyone, but almost everyone probably voted for. But also, it has been very bipartisan on the national level. It was Ronald Reagan who actually suggested changing some of the way the things worked in that program in 1986 when the tax reform. This was a piece of that pushed by Ronald Reagan, and Speaker Ryan supported this last year. So this has never been an idea as far as whether or not it's a Democratic or Republican. But what it does, and studies have shown this on the federal earned income tax credit, when they've studied that, that it raises employment rates for women, it lowers child poverty rates, it lowers welfare caseloads, and has provided a great transition when people move from welfare to work. This is kind of a bridge that motivates them and creates more work opportunities. Who does it go to? About 14% of all the filers in the state, or 14% of all rural Minnesota filers claim this credit, versus about 12% of all metro filers claim this credit. And I suppose the maximum credit, and what this bill does, it gets you to the maximum credit of about $2,060 for two children quicker, and it phases out slower, and also allows those 21 to 24-year-olds to also qualify. But, you know, if we're really serious about the American dream and getting people there and rewarding family and work, this really is a good bipartisan approach. And I, you know, this is coming out of the estate tax, the increases, not out of the current law. But what is in this House File 4 on the estate tax will provide about, on the average, about $80 million of benefit for about 800 of our wealthiest folks. That's about $100,000 per tax filers, $100,000 apiece. And we think, and the philosophy has always been, that we have to have a targeted, strategic approach of tax cuts to those folks who need it the most. And we really think it's these folks, most of them in kind of the second decile, 12 to 24,000 range, that actually has they pay a higher percent of their state and local taxes, of their income in state and local taxes, than the wealthiest folks. So this would be something that would benefit the state overall. Where I mentioned the estate tax is going to benefit about 800 people in the state, this would benefit, working family credit would benefit about 360,000 filers. And this expansion would include about another 107,000 families. And it goes to a lot of parents, but also grandparents who are taking care of children. And that's really important. So, members, I would ask for support on this amendment, the A25 amendment.
Any other discussion to the A25 amendment? Representative Druskowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would encourage a no vote on the amendment. This only extends in the bill or increases in the bill a tax on people after they die, and then instead takes that money and gives it to people who have not earned it.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to say you can't take it with you.
Representative Davids.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Representative Markford made some very good points, and I appreciate taking a look at the amendment. But members, please vote no. I just can't take the risk because I put $100 million in the Working Family Credit last year, and the governor vetoed my bill. I want this bill signed. We must come together, members. Please vote no.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hausman.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I think I need a little more explanation than that because it doesn't quite ring true from the way I understand how things went. And I think the surprise in this bill, I mean, because that was in the last bill, and you've managed to find room for so many other things in this bill, including the estate tax, which I think... this is matches the federal level exemption currently for estates valued at $5.49 million. I don't think there are probably in Minnesota many of those estates. So I just wonder why you backed away from the Working Family Credit when you found room for so much besides that in the bill.
Representative Davids.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman, Representative Hausman. First of all, there were state tax provisions in last year's bill also. We decided as a committee to go more with the child care tax credit rather than the working family credit. So we do have child care tax credits in the bill. They're very substantial. Also, as far as the estate tax bill, the first bill that we heard this year was an estate tax bill brought to us by my good friend, Representative Peter Fisher, a DFLer, who was pushing very, very hard to increase the estate tax closer to the federal level. So very bipartisan on the estate tax issue. I know some people get a little divisive on it sometimes, but this is the come-together tax bill, and we must.
Representative Markford.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. Just a couple more comments. But first of all, I'd like to call for a roll call.
Roll call will be called for.
Thank you. Members, this you have to be working to earn the credit. You have to be working to do that. And, you know, you've got someone who's working 40 hours a week, 52 weeks a year at the minimum wage at $950. That's $19,760, I think. Under $20,000. And, you know, you look at the salary we make currently is quite a bit more than that. And, you know, that $700 to $900 on the average that they get back, that goes right back into the economy, like right now. And, you know, it's used for, you know, it might be a repair, it might be used for clothing, might be used for insurance, might be used to help these people go back for training to try to better themselves. So this is money well used. And so, again, I think it's a choice here between those who can really, really use this, you know, up to 370,000 people versus 800 of our wealthiest folks who would see an average of a $100,000 tax cut by this increase in the estate tax. So ask for your yes vote, please.
Seeing no further discussion, the clerk will take the roll on the A25 amendment.
Representative Nava?
No.
Representative Vogel?
No.
Representative Carlson?
Yes.
Representative Anderson?
No.
Representative Baker?
No.
Representative Davids?
No.
Representative Cornish?
No.
Representative Dean?
No.
Representative Detmer?
No.
Representative Drazkowski?
No.
Representative Fabian?
No.
Representative Garofalo?
No.
Representative Gunther?
No.
Representative Hamilton?
No.
Representative Hausman?
Yes.
Representative Hillstrom?
Yes.
Representative Hornstein?
Yes.
Representative Liebling?
Yes.
Representative Moon?
No.
Representative Marquardt?
Yes.
Representative Murphy?
Yes.
Representative Mornes?
No.
Representative Pulowski?
Yes.
Representative Poppy?
Yes.
Representative Torkelson? Representative Erdahl? Representative Wagenius?
Yes.
Representative Erdahl, we're in the middle of a roll call. Do you wish to vote on the A25 amendment?
I think I want to vote yes.
No.
Wait a second.
he's a moderate.
How did you vote, Chernawa?
It's the right vote.
I voted no, Representative Erdahl.
Oh, gee. I think I'll vote no.
Erdahl votes no.
Someone right. Like his first vote better on this side.
You. I'm sorry.
You.
All right, members, there being 10 ayes and 16 nays, the motion does not prevail. The A25 amendment is not adopted. Are there any other amendments? Representative Murphy.
Thank you. Mr. Chair and members, I think this is the first amendment I have moved in the Ways and Means Committee. I'm very excited about it. I have the A24.
Representative Murphy moves the A24 amendment. Representative Murphy,
thank
can you
Mr.
describe
Chair.
The amendment?
Yes, Mr. Chair, Representative Davids, when I served on the tax committee in my second term, you were on the committee, and I carried a bill dealing with the tobacco tax, and you were my strongest opponent on that committee. So I thought I would bring it back. I thought we'd come back to the question of taxes, tobacco taxes. So first and foremost, I want to say that I think the tax cut target for this bill is too big. It's too high. It's too deep. And other things that are important to me and to the people of Minnesota, I think, are at stake when I think about early learning and pre-K and health and human services. I worry about that. So this amendment just does one thing, and it strips out the provision about the excise tax on tobacco, that inflator that got put in place when we raised the tobacco tax in 2013. And the reason why I think it's important is because, as I view this is a giveaway to big tobacco. And when I think of the things that are at stake here in Minnesota as a result of this big tax cut bill, I don't know about why we're favoring big tobacco over like 4-year-olds in pre-K or people with disabilities in health and human services. And so for that reason, I would ask your support in stripping out that provision and letting that funding fall at the bottom line. We can use it for something else. Thank you.
Other discussion? Representative Davids?
Yeah, just briefly, Mr. Chair, we're not cutting the cigarette tax. We are not cutting the cigarette tax, first of all. Tax on a pack of cigarettes in North Dakota is 44 cents. It's $3.04 in Minnesota. Putting things on an inflator, putting tax on an inflator is bad tax policy. So you can argue about the tobacco issue, but you can also argue that, which I would, is that putting taxes on inflators is bad tax policy. And I would say in last year's bill, 89% of legislature voted for the bill with this provision, and of course there's many other good provisions, but every Democrat in the Senate voted for this bill. And I would just ask, if I could, Representative Murphy a question. Have you asked Congressman Walz on his position on this issue?
Representative Murphy, will you yield?
Mr. Chair, I have not asked that question.
Mr. Chairman,
Representative David,
you may wish to, just a little heads up there. Okay, so with that being said, and any time a neighboring state is so far out of whack on a tax policy, I know in the tax bill and the governor's proposals in the past, they've asked for smoking hot tobacco cops. Why do they need smoking hot tobacco cops? Because there's a lot of crime going on here. I believe over 30% of the cigarettes smoked in this fine state are smuggled cigarettes. So when you're that far out of whack, you do other things. People are still getting the cigarettes. They go on the internet, they go out of state. My district that I'm so fortunate to represent, Rivers Island, Wisconsin. Okay, and so they're not buying cigarettes in Minnesota, but they're still smoking. So I would just respectfully ask for a no vote on the E24 amendment. Thank you.
Any other discussion to the A24 amendment? Representative Carlson.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I'd like to chime in on this. Those of the members on the tax committee heard me tell a bit of a personal story this past legislative session, but my father went into World War II as a non-smoker. They gave out free cigarettes, and he came out a chain smoker, and years later, he had emphysema. He had to take an early retirement from the railroad because he was working outside, and his lungs were so bad that he could no longer work. And the end result was, when he took early retirement, he had a smaller pension when he passed away, smoke-related issues. My mother had a smaller pension, and she lived to be 88 years old on a smaller pension, all due to smoking. So this is an issue I feel rather strongly about. I grew up in a household with a lot of secondhand smoke, and I, to this day, read any article I see in the paper dealing with secondhand smoke, because that's the environment that I grew up in. I had four siblings. We all grew up. Didn't really realize it while we were growing up. When I went away to college and I would come home, that was when you'd really notice it, because I'd be gone a few weeks and walk into that house, and you could literally cut the smoke with a knife. And my father, he loved his children. At that point in time, he would have thought that he was putting their health at risk. He probably would have quit, and I wish he would have. So that's where I come at this issue personally. But I would point out, and Chair Davids knows that we did have testimony in the tax committee that the purchase of cigarettes among young people, they're particularly salary sensitive, or cost sensitive. We've probably heard the information, the ads and so on, that if they don't start smoking by something like 20 years old, I forget the exact year there, they probably never will smoke. But younger people are very cost sensitive, and that's one of the reasons that I support this particular amendment and would encourage people to support it as well. Just as another little personal aside, my father's uncle lived to be 102. My grandfather, his dad, lived to be 96, and I think those would have been his genes had he not been a chain smoker for so many years. And we lost him, he was younger than I am today. And it was related to the emphysema on the smoking. So with that, I would encourage a yes vote on the amendment.
Representative Liebling.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I was just really going to say what Representative Carlson ended up saying, that this is not really just a tax policy. This is a public health policy. And it's one of the most effective public health policies that we have, because young people in particular are very price sensitive. And as the price of cigarettes goes up, the number of young people who start smoking goes down. And so I think that's really a policy worth protecting, even if there is some bootlegging of cigarettes. I don't know how big a problem that is, but we have sure seen results from raising the tax on cigarettes. And we know that around here it's just about impossible to raise a tax. It's real easy to cut taxes. And having an inflator allows us to keep up with inflation and keep on raising that price of cigarettes to keep cutting down the number of people, the number of young people in particular, who become addicted to what is a very, very serious addictive substance, and that is nicotine. And we all know that this is a substance that kills. So I think this is a really important amendment that Representative Murphy is putting forward, and I hope that everyone will support it, because this is about our kids. Thank you.
Chair Davids.
Well, just one comment from a good friend from Olmsted. She said around this place, it's real easy to cut taxes. I haven't found that to be the case.
Any other discussion? Seeing none, all in favor of the 824 amendment, say aye.
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 Opposed?
No.
Mosby does not prevail. The 824 amendment is not adopted.
Thanks, Dean.
Discussion to the bill, unless there are other amendments of which I'm unaware. Well, Representative Hausman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wanted to just speak to the size of the bill and the context. I don't know if it was in this committee, but somewhere along the line, we were given the revenue forecast uncertainty report. And it says, Minnesota's February 2017 economic and revenue forecasts carry a large degree of uncertainty related to U.S. economic policy. And so when there was a press conference on the targets, I saw a couple of numbers talked about. One was in this $1.6 billion projected surplus that there would be a $1.35 billion in tax relief and $1.1 billion in new funding for K-12 schools. So as constituents have come into my office, I have started talking about this, this $1.6 billion projected surplus, and they're projecting a $1.35 billion tax relief and $1.1 billion in new funding for K-12, at which point I stop and say, what do you think so far? And inevitably, everyone has said the same thing. It doesn't add up. So as people look at these numbers, it doesn't add up for them how, with that surplus, we can cut taxes to this level and still claim we are raising new spending. Because we have a history of this in the state, a fairly recent history, in the Ventura and Pawlenty eras when we had money, and so we gave it back and we cut taxes, and we very quickly were in a deficit. But because we still had to balance the budget, we started doing shifts and gimmicks, and we borrowed from the schools. And it was so bad that the rating agencies looked at Minnesota, and they specifically said, we don't like how the state is balancing their budget. We're going to lower their rating. And they did. We have just turned all of that around. We're back to structural balance. The rating agencies have again improved our credit rating. We have repaid the schools. I think we've repaid all of the shifts that I'm aware of. And to do this bill in the context of that revenue forecast uncertainty is the thing that troubles me. And I hope that it doesn't start us down that same path that that we have just completed.
So, Mr. Chair, years ago when our governor was Jesse Ventura, and I think if I recall right, the House and Senate were of opposite parties then, I was fairly newly, I hadn't been back in the state too terribly long, and I wasn't paying really a lot of attention to politics. But what really caught my attention was when there was a lot of news about the fact that the legislature and the governor were arguing about how to send out, how to return. There was a surplus, and there was a lot of argument about how to send out money to back to the citizens. And I was watching this debate as a pretty uninvolved citizen at that time. And I watched this going on, and I read in the newspaper that it was going to cost some millions of dollars just to send out those checks, what came to be known as the Jesse checks. And I was a parent of kids in school at that time, and I just thought, well, isn't this ridiculous? Don't we have needs in this state? I knew that in my own kids' school that we were being asked to bring in more and more supplies that we weren't keeping up, and it was becoming pretty evident in the classroom. And yet the legislature was having a big debate about how to send out checks. Who would get the money? That seemed to be the big question. And that made me pay attention, and that eventually led to me running for office. Well, here we are again. I think that this amount of tax cutting at a time, as Representative Hausman said, when we have this great uncertainty, but also because I've now come to understand that the way we do a forecasting means that there isn't necessarily $1.3 or $1.6 billion sitting around anywhere for us to tap. Actually, I'd like to ask Mr. Marks, I don't have the figure, but I know that because we do our budgeting without adding inflation to our revenues, I know that MMB calculates another number.
Expenses.
So we don't add the money that we are spending, our expenses, we don't add inflation. And yet MMB always calculates that. And I wonder if you could tell us what the number is that they've calculated, that if inflation had been added, what would be our surplus number? Do you have that available?
Mr. Marks.
Mr. Chair and Representative Liebling, the cost of inflation as MMB estimated it in the February forecast for fiscal years 18 and 19 would be, it'd be the sum of $362 million and $748 million. $362 for fiscal 18 and $748 for fiscal 19.
Well, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Marks. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so with my quick addition here, that comes to over $1 billion, $1,110,000,000. I don't know if other people are checking the math on that as well. $1,110,000,000, that's just the cost of inflation. So without doing the other subtraction here, that significantly reduces the so-called surplus. So I submit to you that we don't really have much of a surplus in the state. But what Republicans are doing is proposing to cut taxes to such a degree that really you're giving away, or you're sending out the door our the money that would have funded just keeping even with inflation. I think that's really problematic. I think it's not in the best interest of the state. And what do we see in the other budget targets that are
necessary because of this decision that the Republicans are making. In the Health and Human Service area, we're seeing a substantial cut of around $600 million. We're seeing in that bill very little for people with disabilities who came to us person after person telling us that they're in a desperate situation because the caregivers need even a little bit of a rate increase, and they are getting nothing because here we are giving tax cuts, some of which at least are going to the very wealthiest Minnesotans after they die when they can't take it with them. So, Mr. Chair and members, I think this is an absolutely irresponsible bill, and I would urge people not to support it.
Well, if I could reply just a little bit to some of the statements from Representative Hausman and Representative Liebling. Representative Hausman, you said, how does a $1.35 billion tax cut and a $1.1 billion education increase add up when you've only got a $1.65 billion surplus? The answer is that you're counting the money two different ways. If you count the money the way most people in Minnesota, I think, count money, you say, well, how much money did we spend in our last budget? And how much are we planning on spending this year in our next budget? And if you do that for K-12 education, there will be, at least underneath the House Republican plan, a $1.1 billion increase comparing what we are planning to spend on the next budget that we are planning on passing as compared to what we spent in the last budget over the last 2 years, a $1.1 billion increase. And those numbers are very easily verifiable. It's all right in the state budget forecast and our targets. It's very easy to verify that. The tax number, the $1.35 billion surplus, is actually, or the $1.35 billion tax cut number, or the $1.65 billion surplus, is what is left over after you've already assumed a $3 billion increase in spending based on current law. And so the House Republican budget is proposing to have a $1.1 billion increase in spending, and because we have been blessed with a significant forecasted surplus, there is still $1.35 billion to put towards tax cuts. And, you know, I guess to Representative Liebling on that uncertainty report you're quoting, I was the author of that, something I've worked on the last couple of years. That's why you're seeing it. Is it something that I authored? And with Democrat Senator Dick Cohen, we agreed on the last supplemental budget. If you look at it closely, you'll see that they are saying that there's an equal chance of there being a $2.4 billion additional surplus as opposed to having $2.4 billion unrealized. So, yes, there is uncertainty, but it is uncertainty that certainly cuts both ways, and that's why we have a couple billion dollar budget reserve and rainy day fund. But, you know, I certainly respect your opinions. I just felt I have to give another side to it. So, other discussion. Representative Carlson.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I was listening to what you said, and As it was when we were debating the budget resolution, I pointed out that the numbers you're using are over a four-year period, so you'd have quite a different look if you amateurized that, if you will, over 4 years. But I was prepared to comment a little bit, and you brought it up on the risk factor. If you'll recall, when we had testimony from the state economist, I asked that question because I, like you, sit in on the Council of Economic Advisors, and they spend quite a bit of time talking about the risk. And the points that they made was that we've had the longest period of economic growth probably any time in our modern history, at least maybe in history. And there's concern that that will come to an end at some point. In fact, they talked about the second year of the biennium. Two quarters in particular are at high risk. And when they presented the report to us, they pointed out that from November until February, they increased the risk factor by 5%. I think it was 25% originally, and they increased it to 30%, or some numbers fairly close to that. So I think we have to keep that in mind, and I think a couple of members on our side were trying to point that out, because when we did have those tax cuts under the Ventura administration, many people would say that that set the stage for literally a 10-year roller coaster that the state of Minnesota was on, trying to resolve and deal with various deficits. But one other point that I want to make is that the way you've structured the budget overall, it's really not a balanced approach. And when we were dealing last Thursday with the budget resolution, we tried to point out that there was a better way. We pointed out that we should put a greater priority on education. We had basically three amendments. One of them I carried, which was the governor's budget, which was much more balanced than what's before us. And then we did focus on education and higher education. And I felt for years that that's where the future of the state of Minnesota is, in a high-quality workforce, a good, well-educated citizenry is strong not only for our workforce, but for democracy. We educate for democracy. And Minnesota has slipped. There was a time in my period here in the legislature when we were probably somewhere in the top three in terms of our commitment per student, with the K-12 finance bill, as we called it then, or now E-12. And we've now slipped, I think we're number 15. We're probably down in the mid-tier. So we're not making the investment that we did at one time. And now that bill will be up before us tomorrow, but I point that out this evening because you're putting basically so many resources into this particular bill that it's really starving the rest of the state budget, and an area that I'm particularly concerned about and always have been, and it's part of my legislative history, is education and higher education. Although I would be equally concerned about other areas that I personally haven't worked as much on, health and human services. I think you've got a $600 million cut, if I recall, there. And not to revisit each and every one of those accounts, because we'll have that opportunity when it's before us. But my main message is that this just is not a balanced approach to the state budget. And that's why, at least speaking for myself, I'll be a no vote on this particular bill, recognizing fully that Chair Davids has some good things in it that I like. But it's just simply too rich relative to what it does for the rest of the state budget. So I'll stop there, and I don't know if others want to comment or if you're ready to go to a vote.
Representative Hornstein?
Just very quickly, Mr. Chair, I just wanted to comment on the couple of transportation provisions. We normally don't have those in a tax bill, but we are shifting $460 million from the general fund into transportation, and that's very risky. They did this in Wisconsin a couple years ago. There was a deficit, and one of the first things they did to address the deficit was to scoop up the transportation general fund money. And so I worry that the minute we start running deficits again or don't have surpluses to this extent, we're going to take transportation money. This is money that goes to schools, it goes to fund senior programs, nursing homes, etc. So I'm very concerned about this. In the Transportation Committee, Mr. Chair, we heard from the contractors, we heard from the people that build the roads and bridges, and they want a stable, dedicated, reliable source of money that we have normally done in the Constitution through constitutionally dedicated funds in the state. And we're not doing that. We're doing it through a shift in the general fund, and I don't think this is a proper a way to fund roads and bridges. So for that and many other reasons, I'll be voting no on this bill.
And I guess I'd like to respond to a couple of other things that were said. First of all, there it was said that we have a $600 million cut to health and human services. You are right, Representative Carlson, that we are looking at a two-year budget here, because that's the way the state budgets the last 2 years compared to the next 2 years. But we are projecting and proposing on the House Republican side to increase funding for health and human services by $2 billion from the last 2 years to the next 2 years. So I guess, you know, in some cases people would say, well, that's a cut because it's not as much as we would like to spend or others have proposed to spend or we have in current law for some additional spending, but it is nevertheless a $2 billion increase. And, you know, on the uncertainty issue, you know, I hear what people say about the uncertainty issue, and I have, you know, some concerns about that too, but I guess I do feel that if you really are that concerned about the uncertainty issue on the DFL side, you shouldn't be proposing to spend $1 billion of the $1.35 billion that Chair David is coming forward with. You should be proposing to put that $1 billion in the budget reserve. I mean, if you're all that concerned about uncertainty, you ought to put it in the budget reserve. You're simply proposing to spend it. And whether we give it back to the public in the form of tax cuts or we spend it, either way, it's not in the state checkbook. So if that is what your true concern is in terms of uncertainty, I think what you're talking about in terms of the budget that you've brought forward is kind of inconsistent, because under either of these approaches, we're not going to have that money. It's not going to be in some savings account somewhere. And I think that underneath the Republican approach, this would at least grow the economy more, and I think give us some more taxes in the future than we would have if we take the DFL approach. Other discussion? Otherwise, I'll turn it back to the chair for his final comments.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman and members, for the robust discussion. This is an awesome tax bill. It is so awesome, I can hardly believe it. There's no place in the bill where it says and or, so we're fine there. And I would have to make just a few comments, members. Representative Liebling, my good and dear friend from Olmsted, said that this tax bill was irresponsible. Members, it would be irresponsible not to give your full support and push for this tax bill to become law, and have the governor sign it so it does become law. What about the students being crushed by college debt? There's a Davis provision in here, first in the nation, to help people reduce their student debt. First in the nation. 529s, subtractions and credits. If somebody's paying a bunch of tax, they get a subtraction. If they're not paying a bunch of tax, they get a credit. They're both in there so people can save for their kids' college. Chair Drazkowski and his committee did a tremendous job on property tax relief for small businesses, excluding $200,000 on the bottom end, the threshold there. What about the property tax relief for farmers? It's in this bill. So when you say it's irresponsible, you haven't read the bill. Read the bill. This is not an irresponsible bill. This is a very, very responsible bill. Estate tax relief, the first bill we heard. Every year, my 13 years chairing committees, we've heard DFL bills first. Not DFL bills to hear and kill, but DFL bills to hear and pass. Representative Fisher and the Loon provisions and Representative Loon, Chair Loon's estate tax provisions, they're in the bill. That's not irresponsible. That just means so you don't have to sell half your farm so you can keep farming when dad dies. That's all that means. That's a good provision that Representative Loon, Representative Fisher brought to us. And as far as all this uncertainty happy stuff here, read the February forecast. What did it say? It said the February forecast specifically stated that our economic outlook has improved because of possible individual and corporate tax cuts. Personal income and business spending are projected to grow. This bill will continue on the state level. What our budget forecasters have predicted would be positive for the state. Irresponsible? Read the budget forecast. This is not irresponsible. So, members, I would, and then Lead Marquardt, you're wonderful. You did a great job on the tax committee, and I really appreciate it more than you know. You did a great job. So, members, this is a great bill to vote for. I'm proud of this bill. I'm proud of the DFL provisions, the Republican provisions that are in this bill. Read the list. You probably got something in here that you really wanted. You know what? It's in here. It's in here. So, members, I've just covered a few of the provisions that are in here. How about for the senior citizens? I'd like to wipe out all taxation for Social Security like 44 other states have. But what did we do? We took and we raised the threshold so you have a higher amount before you have to start including your Social Security as income. That's very responsible. I may have to rename this from the Come Together tax bill to the most responsible tax bill ever written. I don't know what I will do on that. I'd have to write a whole bunch of new words, and I probably won't do that.
So, and then my good friend Representative Carlson said, this budget is, it's starving the state budget, a budget that starves the state. What about the people being starved by big government? We have overcharged our citizens $1.6 billion. The citizens are starving. State government is more like me, not starving. Okay, I just got to say, it's not starving. It's doing just fine, and after this bill, it will actually do better. It will do better. So, members, I have a fever, and the only prescription is more tax relief. Come together right now, members, for tax relief. Please vote yes.
Well, with that, Chair Davids renews his motion that House File 4, as amended, be referred to the General Register. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
No. Motion prevails. House File 4, as amended, is referred to the General Register.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, members.
Thank you, Chair Davids. All right, members, the next item is House File 888, the Omnibus Environment Finance Bill. Chair Fabian moves that House File 888 be referred to the General Register. And Chair Fabian, why don't we have you go through your bill, and then we'll take the amendments.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Well, it's good that we got the warm-up band out of the way.
Does that mean you're going to sing?
Well, Mr. Chair and members, House File 888 is our Omnibus Environment Natural Resources Policy and Finance Bill. Our target was $292,785,000, which was a $21 million decrease from the base. We did meet our target. We did fund the governor's some of his recommendations, the business friendly data services. We funded that from the environmental fund instead of from the general fund for $100,000. We funded $1 million for environmental review and permitting reforms from the environmental fund. We did do the park entrance fee increase of $2 for daily and $10 for the year. The governor's recommendation for the sustainable timber harvest analysis, taking that from the forest management investment account instead of the general fund, that was $500,000 for the biennium. We funded $1 million below the governor's reforestation of DNR forest lands. We put that in at $4 million for the biennium. Conservation officer training academy, we funded that at $2.7 million. We funded the proceedings for Polymet DNR is charged with defending that. That was $5 million. The governor's request was for $6.9 million. We also funded another $1 million for permitting reform from the general fund. Bowser wound up with a $22 million decrease because of the SWCD grants now coming from the legacy bill. Vet Council, Parks, the Science Museum, Conservation Corps, Explorer, Minnesota were no charge or no change from the base. Minnesota Zoo got a $1 million extra for the biennium. And we also put a $500,000 for the school trust lands administrator to do work to get the lands that are locked inside the Boundary Waters canoe area, try to get those lands out of there in exchange for federal lands so that we can actually put those lands to work. Raise money for the students. And that's just a brief summary, Mr. Chair. I'd be happy to answer more questions.
Okay, members, I think let's turn to the amendments we've got, and then we can take discussion on the bill. Members, the first amendment is the A24 amendment. The chair will move the A24 amendment. Members, what this relates to is there was a amendment put on in the Environment Finance Committee dealing with rulemaking by the PCA, and where there were questions that came up in court and contested cases, there were issues about appointing a scientific review panel that would review work that was done and provide additional testimony for the court. And as I looked at the fiscal note related to that, it's not a general fund expenditure, it's an environmental fund expenditure, but as I looked at it, there was, at least according to the fiscal note, which I think is kind of out of balance, but nevertheless, there was more money being spent in the fiscal note than there was money available in the environmental fund. And I guess I saw that as a problem. And so what this amendment would do is it would say this does not apply to industrial or mining permits that are being contested. It's basically going to be leaving it more towards municipalities, which is, I think, where the thrust of the amendment was. And so, members, this is an amendment to basically reduce the cost of that amendment that was added on in the Environment Finance Committee to make sure that we aren't blowing the budget of the Environmental Fund. Are there any questions to the A24 amendment? Representative Lagini.
Well, actually, Mr. Chair, I think it's a good amendment, and I support it. However, when we talk about the Environment Fund, I think we have to recognize some of the testimony that the Pollution Control Agency gave to us. And as the money that is being reduced from that fund and being spent in other ways, they have fewer dollars to do permits. And that will make permits slower, which has been something that Representative Fabian has not liked, but is now incorporating into this bill. But it will also do another thing, and that is that folks who get water permits only spend about, or only have to pay about 15% of the cost of that permit. So the rest of it comes out of the Environment Fund. So now I think you're taking us on a track to raise permit fees from 15% of the cost of each permit to something more. That's just an observation. I do support this amendment.
Okay, thank you, Representative Lagunas. Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this isn't directly related to the amendment, but it's related to the issue after the amendment is adopted or not adopted, so I can wait and if you'll come back to me.
Yeah, I'll certainly come back to you. Let's deal with the amendment. Other questions to the amendment? See no discussion. All in favor of the A24 amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. The A24 amendment is adopted. Okay, next, members, we have the A26 amendment. The chair will move the A26 amendment, but I'd like to add an oral amendment at the bottom that inserts the words adjust amounts accordingly so that the rest of the bill now balances with this. There's language in the bill relating to a certain freeway landfill, and there were concerns about the cost of that freeway landfill and where the money was coming from. The fiscal note I looked at, I thought, was extremely unrealistic in terms of how much money they thought might have to be paid for the mitigation of this landfill over the next biennium. And to make sure that we're not talking about that money coming out of the general fund and to be more realistic, I talked to staff and came up with this amendment that basically says that the feasibility work and the other design and pre-design type work that would go into this project would be limited to $4 million in the first year and that this money would come out of the closed landfill fund. And members, I guess I think that that's a more suitable source for this. I know that there are certainly other landfills that are going to have claims on that fund, too. That all starts, I believe, in 2020.
But there is, I recall correctly, some $50 million, $40-some million anyway, in the closed landfill fund at the current time, and so there's certainly the capacity to do this. So, members, I'd appreciate your support on that. Representative Wagenius.
Well, Mr. Chair, I think this is not a workable amendment, and here's why. The landfill that you're talking about, Freeway Landfill, is a federal Superfund site. The federal Superfund site. You're giving the money to the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. That first doesn't make any sense. Secondly, the guy who owns the landfill had every opportunity to get into the closed landfill program. He chose not to do that. We just can't walk on his land and say, we're getting ready to do all of this work on your land. I mean, it implies to me that you are suggesting that the PCA, no, federal government, it would have to be, should condemn the landfill, because this is private property right now. So this amendment is, I guess I would say, is premature at best. It doesn't work.
Well, Representative Wagenius, there is a considerable amount of other language related to that landfill that is in the bill right now, and this amendment is not removing any of it. And I guess I'll probably defer to Representative Fabian to talk more about that other language. But go ahead, Representative Wagenius.
Well, one of the things I would have talked about is, what I was planning to talk about, since this is the Finance Committee, that other language indemnifies responsible parties, people that the federal government have identified in their Superfund process. We've never indemnified people. The landfill bill that we have now does not indemnify anybody. And we have no idea what indemnification means. It's not defined. So it may be cost of the landfill, if it's condemned, I suppose. It may be attorney's fees. Who knows what it means? So it's like opening the state's checkbook without an appropriation. And I think it's absolutely inappropriate and not fiscally responsible, because we are supposed to appropriate money for a certain defined thing. I mean, I'm thinking about Speaker Dowd's memo to all of us. It was a good memo. But anyway, the whole idea behind the bill, the language in the bill, is not what we did in the closed landfill program that we have right now. Extremely different. We have no idea what it's going to cost. And you may us say that 70 or 50 or whatever million dollars is too much. We have no idea. We have no clue. I know that PCA had estimated the cost at $64 million in a because it's sitting on the river and it's going to affect the drinking water system of Burnsville. This is not an easy task before anybody. But we can't do it anyway because we don't own the land and it's in a federal Superfund site. So I think this language is premature and I'm going to vote against it.
Okay. Other discussion? Representative Fabian.
Mr. Chair, thank you. The Freeway Landfill is very complicated. There's no doubt about that. And the interesting thing, and we heard in testimony, is that the insurance companies had settled with MPCA and wound up with, I believe, roughly $100 million in settlement. And then the lawyers got about 30% of that. That money was put into the closed landfill fund. And then, of course, as we've gone through this period of 20-plus years, now it winds up in the hands of the EPA, the feds, and now these people who put waste into the landfill are being served notice that the agreement that they had with MPCA, that all their costs incurred in the closure that had been met are now not going to be met, and they will be potential responsible parties. The PRPs are being served with notice by the EPA that they're going to be incurring very, very significant expense again. And a lot of these people are extremely concerned. We had heard very, very compelling testimony in committee about it. I've talked to several people about it who are very concerned about what might happen to their business or whatever. And we heard from citizens, elected officials in the area. This is going to have a dramatic impact on potentially hospitals, school districts, and so forth. So we need to proceed and try to come up with a plan that's actually going to get this job done in the end.
Representative Wagenius.
That's the problem. We don't have a plan. We have a recalcitrant, and I'll use that word, landowner, who says, there's nothing wrong here. I don't want you on my property. So we don't have a plan. Everybody else in the, all the other landfills, the 109 that came in, people did so voluntarily. It was a voluntary program. So you can't take a voluntary program and then tell this person they've got to be in it unless we plan to condemn the land. That's possible. I'm not sure I'd go down that route, but that's possible. But what we have right here is not workable, and we need to find a plan that is workable. And just to go back on the insurance issue, you're right about, I think it was actually a little more money than you think, but that money was spent years and years ago on 109 landfills. So this only one landfill was not the source of the insurance money. There were a lot of landfills that had insurance dollars, but they were all settled at once, and that money was long ago spent. It did not go into the this closed landfill fund. That's money that came much later. So I think we have to be very careful and re-look at what we could actually practically do here rather than trying to say to this recalcitrant landowner, we have a plan when we don't.
Representative Horstein.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Representative McGinnis has made the point I was going to make that this was a global agreement with over 100 landfills. So thank you for making that point, Representative McGinnis.
Seeing no further discussion, all in favor of the 826 amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails. The 826 amendment is adopted. Okay, members, the final amendment of which I'm aware is the A25 amendment. Chair will move the A25 amendment. Members, what this amendment does is it says that for counties that choose to pass a resolution saying they don't want the state to buy further land in the county, that the state may not buy further land in the county unless, if they do, they sell an equivalent amount of land. However, I want to make this very clear, page 1, line 4. This is only for counties located in whole or in part north of U.S. Highway 2. U.S. Highway 2 is the highway that runs from East Grand Forks to Duluth. So we're only talking about the very northernmost counties in the state. I've been concerned for some time about just how much land the state of Minnesota does own. Minnesota's, I think, either the third or the fourth largest landowning entity in the country. And many of these counties up in this area have 70% or even more than 80% of their land owned by the government, either the federal government or the state government or some other unit of government. And I think it actually becomes an economic development issue at some point when you have so much land owned by the government that it is an economic drag on these counties up here. So I bring forward this amendment as a concern for those counties that if they choose to adopt this policy, and no one's going to say the county board has to adopt this policy, if the counties choose to adopt this policy, they could adopt this no net gain policy for those counties that are north in whole or in part of U.S. Highway 2. And I would be open now to questions or discussion. Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just have a question about this. So I assume here that what you're concerned about is loss to the tax rolls, loss of taking land off the tax rolls. Is that kind of the underlying concern?
Not necessarily, Representative Liebling. You're probably getting at the fact that we paid pilt on a lot of these lands, but I'm also getting at the issue of just in terms of economic development, once the government owns the land, it tends to never be sold. And when you've got 70 or 80% or more of the land in a county owned by the government, there's just that much less economic development availability to go on because there isn't all that much land to put it on.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I guess my second part to that was you say here, must sell to a private individual or entity. And do you include in that a private nonprofit?
Representative Liebling, yes.
Okay. Just wanted to make clear because that's kind of why I was asking about the tax issue. Thank you.
Representative Hausman.
Mr. Chair, and Alliance 115-16, land sold under this paragraph must not be sold for less than 75% of the appraised value. What can you help me understand why the 75% of?
Well, I guess I wanted to create a situation where, if there aren't necessarily going to be that many offers for some of this land, and this would only take effect if, say, the DNR decided they wanted to buy land up there, and so now they had to sell some. There's not necessarily a big market for all this land, and if someone, wants to offer, right now you can't sell it for less than appraised value. If they wanted to offer 95% of appraised value or, even as much as 75%, I wanted to make sure that we could still make some kind of a deal because there's a lot of these sales that up there aren't that many sales, there aren't that many comparables, so it's kind of hard to get a comparable on what the land value is actually worth in an appraisal. Representative Guinness.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I look at your paragraph A and think, well, that's fine, but wonder why we just don't leave it at that. Why we don't respect the counties and say, all right, we're not going to buy any land up there. Why are we going through this very expensive trading or selling and buying when the county doesn't want us involved? Let's just not be involved.
Well, Representative Wagenius, I did think about that, but if the state for some reason feels that they really do need some particular parcel of land, that there's some some environmental feature that they've discovered that we don't have, that they think we really should have, I guess I wanted to leave it open for them to acquire that, provided they then dispose of an equivalent amount of land. Representative Guinness.
Well, if there was something super good, I am sure that the state could come and just get an authorization for that. It seems to me that when we put all this additional language in, as my mother would say, we're just borrowing trouble. Why not just say, we're not going to, you don't want any more? That's okay. You don't have to have any more. I am a little bothered by the additional language, but not paragraph A.
All right. Other discussion? Representative Carlson.
Mr. Chairman, I'm just trying to figure out just how this would work and just a couple of questions of you then as the author of the amendment, but how would this work with the school trust fund lands and the University of Minnesota has lands and that are at one time were primarily throughout the state but now are heavily in what remains in northern Minnesota, and they're buying and selling and trading lands for a variety of reasons involving those trust lands. And what would be the impact on some of that?
Well, Representative Carlson, I think as long as if they wanted to buy more land and they're selling other land of an equivalent value, there wouldn't be an impact.
A How about state parks? And what I'm sitting here thinking about, and I worked with Representative Wagenius, we had a real targeted opportunity on Vermilion Lake when U.S. Steel was selling just a super attractive piece of land, a very large piece of land that we were able to acquire that's right next to the Tower Sedan State Park. And within the county, it was somewhat controversial at the time. There were those that wanted to have that land sold off for lakeshore development. There were other people that I talked to, at least, that were very interested in that being a state park because of the economic development that would come with tourism. So I'm just trying to figure out how something like that would play. We may never see an opportunity like that again with that land on Vermilion, at least that large a tract of land that was really just a tremendous opportunity, in my view. So how would it work with those kinds of situations then, where you'd have somewhat of a division within the county? In this case, pro-lakeshore development versus others that saw the advantage of developing it as a state park and all the visitors that would come up north and spend money and what have you.
Well, I remember Representative Carlson at the time that was pretty controversial because it was, you're right, it was a large, maybe once-in-a-lifetime sort of opportunity to purchase this large parcel of land that was located on a very desirable lake. At the same time, the DNR has told us for years that they don't have the money to maintain the state parks they have. And so I know that within the DNR there was some discussion at that time about whether they actually wanted another park. I guess the way this would work is, first of all, it would be up to the county. I mean, if the county decided that we want the park and we're not going to pass any kind of a resolution adopting this no net gain, then it would be irrelevant. Then the state could go forward and do what they in fact ended up doing, and that is buying the land. If the county had decided, no, we don't want more land owned by the government, by the state government in our county, presumably they would be kind of telling us and passing a resolution that they didn't want the state park. But if they passed a resolution to that effect, they could still end up with a state park if the DNR went forward and bought this land but then sold a equivalent amount of other land.
Would that, Mr. Chairman, that equivalent amount of other land have to be in that same area then, above Highway 2?
I believe the answer, let me look at this, I believe the answer to that is yes. No, it has to be within the same county. Yes. Line 12.
Okay. Line 12. Okay. Well, thank you.
Thank you, sir. Other questions? Representative Bilstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I have a couple of questions about some of the changes that you are doing in some of the processes, both in the DNR section when it comes to contested cases, and then when you can appeal in others. I didn't notice that these bills went to the Public Safety Committee. So is there any fiscal impact, either savings or cost, to the judiciary based on the changes that are in this bill?
You know, Representative Hillstrom, there was a bill that kind of covered the entire state that was similar to this, and I don't know that there were any fiscal costs I saw to that. But I guess I, you know, whether it depends a little bit on what counties would happen to do and whether the state then decided they wanted to go forward with their purchases nevertheless or not.
Mr. Chair, the question really was if there was a fiscal note that related to the judiciary on any of these proposals, and if there is, if they went through the Judiciary Committee. It might be a cost savings. It might be an expense. I don't know. There's just a number of changes, and they, of course, are able to appeal them to the Court of Appeals, and I've seen nothing on it, and I haven't seen a specific fiscal note. So those are fiscal issues for this committee to deal with, Mr. Chair. So I think that those are important questions to be answered.
Representative Hillstrom, can I ask, are your questions referring to this amendment or to the bill as a whole?
Sorry, this is to the bill. I'm sorry, I thought we had...
Okay, all right.
Mr. Chair.
Okay. Any other questions to the 825 amendment? Representative Gruskowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate you bringing forward this type of amendment and language, and it's been a long time coming, and I hope that we can see something enacted in the law, and I shared with you earlier. I wish this was statewide. I think we need to have every county in the state to have this ability, but what I have for you is just one thing to maybe make the amendment a little more workable. On line 1.11, I would propose an amendment to your amendment to insert between the words equal and number the words or greater. And the reason for that, Mr. Chair, is that if you run into situations where the state is going to buy a 12-acre piece of land and the parcel that they have available happens to be 15 acres, they wouldn't have to go forward and do all the surveying and other costs that are associated with it, counterproductive both in terms of cash costs and cost and time to the agency. So just give the agency more flexibility and a common sense amendment to your amendment, sir.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Gruskowski. I guess I would consider that a friendly amendment that I'd incorporated in. I don't think it really, it just would give them the option of doing an equal or greater number of acres if the agency chose to do that. Other discussion to the 825 amendment? Seeing no other discussion, all in favor of the 825 amendment with the incorporated language, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
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 Motion prevails. The 825 amendment is adopted. Okay, members, we now have the bill as amended before us. So a discussion on the bill. Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And again, I apologize. I was looking at the entire sections, and there are a number of proposals that where we change processes through the DNR, through the permitting, through when things are appealable to the Court of Appeals. And so my question is, I don't remember seeing any of these provisions in the Judiciary Committee, Public Safety Committee. So do we have a fiscal note to know if there are cost savings or cost expenditure to the Judiciary
I guess I'm wondering, Representative Hillstrom, we can call the fiscal analyst up forward, but do you have maybe a particular example you could refer to help us answer your question?
Well, certainly, Mr. Chair. So there are new provisions that are on line 105.4.
Which page are you on?
Page 105.4.
Okay.
That's where they've modified the provisions on the number of days that something can be appealed, and it actually modifies when and what they can appeal. So I just want to know if it's a cost savings or if it's a expenditure, Mr. Chair. And then there's also a section where they do this expert review panel, and now you're going to have this additional information that's going to become part of the record. So now then if that is then appealed through the Court of Appeals, is that a cost savings or a cost expenditure to the judiciary upon appeal?
Well, I don't know if I can answer the first example, but I think I can answer the second, Representative Hillstrom, because that relates to the First Amendment that we had. And we did have a fiscal note for that language about those reviews that indicated a cost of $8.7 million out of the Environment Fund. And as I mentioned in the First Amendment, I thought that while I guess I question if it really would be that much money, in any case, there's not that much money in the Environment Fund, and that concerned me. So we added on the amendment that I proposed to take industrial and mining type permits out of it, which should drop that, at least according to the fiscal note, by something in the range of $3.5 to $4 million. So we did have a fiscal note on that. Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. But so now my question is then if you take it one step further, take it to the appeal, right? The Court of Appeals, after this is all decided through the administrative law process, I assume at some point folks can take this through the Court of Appeals. Usually folks can do that. So my question is, is it cost savings or a cost expenditure for these modifications?
You know, Representative Hillstrom, I guess I don't remember the fiscal note in detail. There were a couple of different agencies that had costs involved in it. I guess I would assume that the fiscal note took into account all the various costs that the agency or the state thought there could be there, and so I guess I would expect that those costs were considered. But I guess I don't have a fiscal note in front of me, and I can't remember it in detail.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Maybe we can take a look at it after. But then I do have another question related to the reason there's some language in the bill. I'm noticing that in a number of sections, in Section 107 and Section 108 and in one other section, there's new language that's being added that keeps certain governmental behaviors or agencies moving along even in the event of government shutdown. And Mr. Chair, I don't usually see those in bills. And I'm a little nervous that at this point you maybe are thinking that the state is on its way to a government shutdown in this budget cycle. So my question is it typical to add this kinds of language in this bill to order that certain government functions continue in the event of a government shutdown, or is this new based on the current makeup of the government that we have?
Well, Representative Hilstrom, I would tell you first, I did see that language. It wasn't my idea, but I don't recall what page it's on. Do you have the page so that people can refer to it?
Well, Section 107, Section 108, because there's three.
Page 98, I guess, then. Okay, I'm sorry, I interrupted you. Okay, Section 107.
Section 108.
Okay.
And Section, and Section 4. So three sections in this bill all have the language related to it continuing, even if there is not a budget related to this area of the law in the event of government shutdown.
Well, I think I'd refer that question to the author of the bill, Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Hilstrom, what's going on here, in particularly in Section 108, I'm looking for the language in 107. I'm not sure that I see that. What lines do you see that on?
I actually was referring to the House research that's done by nonpartisan staff for those sections as well.
Okay. So in the... In Section 108, with regards to the government shutdown, this would be, if you remember the last time this happened, which nobody really likes to remember that, but it did, there were a number of, the situation exists where a permittee, somebody who is discharging, you know, they have to monitor that discharge all the time. They have to monitor, in some cases, the air quality and what's going on with regards to that permit. And all those things are gathered, all that data is gathered, it's all submitted. And in the case of the previous shutdown, people were, by the special master, were deemed essential services and so forth. And what we don't want to do is have to shut down a facility, a taconite plant, for example, up on the Iron Range. It's so very, very important to the local economy. As long as they are continuing to do the monitoring, and as long as all of the monitoring indicates that all of the emissions are within their permit, I just don't want that facility to be shut down. And that's what it comes down to.
Representative Hilstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So usually we have to have government spending in order approved in order to continue government. And in this state we are not allowed to deficit spend. We're not allowed to spend money that hasn't been allocated. So how is it that you believe that this complies with the requirements of the Minnesota Constitution by ordering government to continue to operate without a bill being passed? Again, I hope that we're not in government shutdown. I would hope that you can pass a budget that can get signed into law. But my concern is how do you actually comply with the rules of the Constitution by adding this language and not funding it?
Through the permitting fees.
Oh, I'm Representative Fabian.
Mr. Chair, thank you. And it would be through the permitting fees, the fees that are collected against the permits.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hilstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. But there has to be a government open to collect them, and there has to be someone to appropriate them. So I just think that there's probably a problem, and you probably should get a budget and shouldn't be in government shutdown. I have nothing else, Mr. Chair.
Well, Representative Hilstrom, it's certainly not our intention to have to deal with that possibility. I will say that, I mean, just from a bigger picture, obviously we have the power as a state to pass a continuing resolution, despite what the Constitution says, and then avoid a government shutdown if we wanted to do that. So, I mean, Representative Fabian is kind of just doing that on a much smaller scale for these particular users of government. Representative Aguinas.
Mr. Chair, I think we're moving to a vote, and I just wanted to make one comment.
Absolutely.
This is a 112-page bill. From pages 1 to 32, it's finance, and from 32 to 112, it's policy. So 28% of this bill is finance, and 72% is policy. And my understanding that the governor asked us to separate policy and finance. And, of course, that's also good practice. So I just wanted to point out the percentages here.
You know, Representative Aguinas, I would say that with respect to the governor, I did get his letter, but I have never seen any legislature of either party comply with that policy. Representative Hornstein.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. There's a lot of things I have concerns about in this bill, but I wanted to call the committee's attention to one of them. With regard to this Volkswagen settlement money, you may recall, you know, that Volkswagen was sued by the Department of Justice for illegally tampering with its vehicle control emission systems, and you know, our state will get $47 million as a result of the settlement. And so we heard a lot of testimony in the Environment Committee, including from the agency, that you know, we might be able to, we may forfeit this money if this language is included, because there is a trustee that's been set up that really is there to make the decisions regarding how this money is allocated. Now, we as a legislature can, you know, have conversations with the agency and make our voices heard. They can get a sense of our preferences, but it's really ultimately the agency under the consent agreement and the trustee that is empowered to make the decision. So if we don't, if we forfeit this money, it'll go to other states, and we could use $47 million for a lot of interesting and important kinds of issues around air quality and cars and whatnot. So I'm very concerned that with this provision we may be forfeiting, or there's a potential to forfeit $47 million from Volkswagen, and I don't think anyone would think that's a good idea.
Representative Nornes.
Mr. Chair, I just had a quick question, something we haven't talked about, I guess. Representative Fabian, Explore Minnesota, it's in the bill here. Is that an increase, or are we flat? How did Explore Minnesota fare?
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Nornes, had a flat.
What?
Yep.
Okay.
Representative Aguinas.
Just a little pushback, Mr. Chair. You said you'd never seen a budget that didn't have extra policy in it. The last budget I took through on environment finance, there was no policy that was not related to finance.
Well, I wasn't here then, Representative Aguinas, so I guess I wouldn't have seen it, but I stand corrected. Other discussion? Representative Fabian, do you want to make any final comments on your bill?
Thank you, Mr. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate the discussion this evening. I would encourage everyone to vote yes on this bill. It was a bipartisan vote in our committee, and I look forward to taking it to the next step.
Okay, with that, Representative Fabian renews his motion that House File 888, as amended, be referred to the General Register. All in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed?
No.
No. Motion prevails. House File 888, as amended, is referred to the General Register. Okay, Representative Carlson.
Now, being that you're about to adjourn, I know we have the bills for tomorrow posted, transportation and education. What do we expect for Wednesday?
I am not sure yet, Representative Carlson, but how about I try to tell you right away tomorrow morning?
Okay.
It's a little bit of a moving target.
We're just trying to do some some planning, and I'd raised the question before.
Yeah, no, we could give. You gave me your great big multi-week roadmap that you had some years back, and I respect that, but we maybe can't see quite that far ahead. So we'll probably have an evening meeting again on Wednesday. We will tomorrow. There's just a lot of committees that are doing stuff during the day, and so that kind of necessitates the evening meeting. But let me get you that in the morning, Representative Carlson.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Seeing none, with that, members, we are adjourned.